At the age of 22, Charles Darwin embarked on a voyage of discovery that would change his life, that would change his view of nature forever, and would have a profound effect on what you think about this world, on what I think about this world, and indeed on what everybody in this whole world now knows is Darwin's theory of evolution. Well, how did he come to this view? At the age of 22, like I said, 1831, he went on a little ship called the HMS Beagle, and it had a mission. This was a time when much of the world had unknown written across its maps. They just didn't know what was out there. The British Navy had to know. They had to know what to expect when they visited some distant port or even some island or some bay that had never been explored before. What was there? Was there anything good to eat? Was there any fresh water? What was the depth of the bay that they could anchor in? Any of these questions, the Admiralty just had to know. And Charles Darwin, at this young age of 22, got the job of naturalist on the HMS Beagle. And so he went around the world in 5 years, collecting samples, making notes, making diagrams, and thinking a lot. Of course, when you're on a ship, you get a lot of chance to do that. So, how did he come to this idea of evolution? I want to focus on just one particular stopover, one particular place where he landed. It's the Galapagos Islands, named after the tortoises that live there. It's located about 600 miles off the west coast of Ecuador, South America. And Darwin was fascinated by this archipelago, by this collection of volcanic islands. Each island seemed to have its own special collection of plants and animals, its own climate, its own rock, its own soil. And so he went about doing what he normally did when he got to these places, and he bagged a few birds and he collected a few tortoises, and he had already learned taxidermy, so he was able to preserve these things for the voyage and made his notes. When he got back to England, he got a friend to lay out all these birds that he collected. He collected quite a few specimens of a brown, boring finch. In fact, these finches came to be known as Darwin's finches. It shows you how significant a part they had to play in his theory. This man identified 13 different species. How did those 13 species get to be there? Now, you have to understand this in the context of what was going on in the scientific religious world of the early 19th century. The Church of England, the Anglican Church, and I guess probably other Protestant churches, maybe even the Catholic Church, held this idea that species, this scientific concept of species, was exactly the same as a biblical kind. Now, they blew it. That's not true. I mean, there's no way that you can necessarily relate the biblical kind from the book of Genesis to the scientific definition of species. They're just two different things. But they went on that premise anyway, and so they concluded that these species are fixed. They cannot change. That would be against God's creative purpose. God created each individual species, and they cannot change. If they were to change, then that would be a violation of God's intended purpose. Everything in a place, and a place for everything. That's how the Victorian mind of England thought. Well, then they got stuck on that particular problem, because someone would raise a tricky question like, well, you've got a big-eared elephant in Africa and a little-eared elephant in India. Surely they're related. Well, if you say that they're related, that means they had a common ancestor. Well, if they had a common ancestor, that means that they had to change from that common ancestor. You cannot have change. That would be against God's intended creation. So what you've got then is this kind of corollary, this secondary theory that says, well, God must have put the kangaroos in Australia, he put the opossums in America, and he put the big-eared elephant in Africa, and he put the little-eared elephant in India, and everything has its place, and it cannot change. Darwin just knew that that wasn't right. He was convinced that that was just too hard to believe. He was incredulous. He was convinced that species, in fact, do change. And his theory might have gone something like this, and I don't think he ever put this in his books. I can't remember. It's been such a long time since I read him. But he would have said something like this, hypothetically. Imagine a flock of these finches flying off the coast of South America, and they get caught by a storm. And they get shifted over to one of these islands on the Galapagos. Now, it just happens that some of them are able to eat the only thing that's available for food on that island, cacti, cactuses. It's the only thing that's there to eat. And some of these birds think that cactuses are just fine, just like some people think that okra is just fine, or these other foods that you have here in the South. If I had to survive just on okra and turnip greens and things like that, biscuits and gravy, I don't know what I would do. But I've been able to adapt by finding the right things to eat. So this is the problem with these finches, is that maybe some of them could find the cacti to eat and had no problem doing that, and some of them couldn't. So the ones that could eat, well, they were the ones that survived. Specifically, they were the ones who were able to produce more offspring. More of them survived than any of the other kind. Whatever it was about that, these particular finches, their behavior, the shape of their beak, the length of their beak, whatever it was, whatever trait, whatever characteristic it was that enabled them to eat this cacti and survive well enough to have the most offspring, these are the ones that would survive. This trait would be the one that survived. Well, the ones that couldn't eat or wouldn't eat, they were the ones that died out. And so they wouldn't pass whatever traits that they had on to the next generation. Well, eventually, Darwin thought, you know, as time goes on, perhaps new things begin to happen. Not only do you have a bunch of cactus-eating finches now, but you've got perhaps predation. A snake comes on the island and starts preying on their eggs. Or you've got competition from another group of birds, another species of birds. Whatever it is, all these pressures from nature acting upon this flock of finches, and eventually they may not be able to reproduce with the other original finches from the mainland, and there you have it. You have a new species born into the natural world. You can carry that on. Imagine another flock of birds comes onto the Galapagos and lands on a different island with a different set of conditions. And they get split off, or this other flock gets split off, or whatever. And eventually, with all this variation within the Galapagos, you would have 13 or whatever different species. So Charles Darwin called this process natural selection. It is nature. Not like in a intelligent way, we'll get to that in a minute, but nature kind of selecting out those characteristics, those traits that favor more offspring, that will favor the most number of offspring within that particular group or that particular population of animals. He called that natural selection. And he knew that that theory would create a big stir in the religious community, because people believed that species were fixed. So when he got back to England, he did some research and he did some experiments, and he just began looking for a way to show that species can in fact change. And what he did is he drew an analogy from the world of agriculture and sports breeding, domestic breeding, an analogy from artificial selection. He said, well, look at something like the horse. You've got this tremendous variation. You've got the Shetland pony at one end and the Clydesdale at the other end. You've got, well, I don't know if he had Chihuahuas back in those days, but the Chihuahua dog at one end and the Great Dane at the other. Tremendous variation, totally as a result of man's handiwork. Man selecting what he wanted to from these different animals and plants, roses, pigs, whatever it happened to be. And so what Darwin hoped to show by using artificial selection is drawing that analogy to natural selection. And he said this, he said, if man can achieve this much, so much variation within a short period of time, imagine what the powers of nature could do over long eons of geological time. And he put those theories together, the artificial selection, the analogy, and his discussion of what he had found on his journey into a book which eventually was published in 1859 called The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. Now, just let's stop there for a minute and look at just those ideas. I believe he made two mistakes right off the bat. Very intelligent man, very well informed. I do not pretend that I have anything, a candle to show, to, you know, candle, my candle light would be swamped by Charles Darwin. But I believe nonetheless that he made two mistakes. First of all, natural selection is limited. Natural selection can only select what is already present in the population. Let's look at our finches again. That trait, whatever it was, that set of traits that favored those finches to eat cactus was already there. All nature did was change the balance of the individuals within that population, of those who could eat cacti and those who couldn't. That's all it did. In fact, there's a famous textbook example. You open up a high school biology textbook, and you'll see a discussion of the finches, and then you also see a discussion of something called the English peppered moth, a very famous example, and how this used to be that the English peppered moth predominantly was mottled, a mottled gray color, and it was well camouflaged against the oak bark and against the lichen-covered rocks. And then the Industrial Revolution came along, and there was another variety, another different form of this peppered moth that was born, that was very dark. It was almost black looking. And of course, against that soot-covered trees and the soot-covered rocks, it was well camouflaged from its bird predators. And so, guess what? The dark-colored variety became more common. Well, of course, since then, in the last 50 years, the amount of pollution has diminished and that soot is no longer there, and the gray mottled kind is becoming more popular or more populous once again. A fine example of natural selection. I am a believer in natural selection. Natural selection is a great, wonderful idea. We see it going around us all the time. I have no problem with that. But what did we start out with? The English peppered moth. What did we have halfway through? The English peppered moth. What did we have at the end? The English peppered moth. We actually didn't create a new species. Now, again, I'm not saying that it's not possible to create new species. But can we go from there to what Darwin said? Darwin said that we can go from this limited change, and now we can explain every single living thing. If 13 species of finches can descend from one parent population, then everything, you, me, chimps, apes, giraffes, hippopotamuses, lizards, snakes, birds, dinosaurs, everything came from a single or a few common ancestors. That is a mighty big jump to make. It is not supported by natural selection. You cannot do that. You cannot reason from limited or microevolution, limited variation, to macroevolution, large-scale, long-term change. It's not supported by natural selection. The second mistake, perhaps a minor mistake by comparison, is this analogy to artificial selection. There's a big difference there, and I alluded to that when I discussed it. You've got man's intelligence at work, picking out which cow it is that has the most milk, picking out which pig produces the most bacon, which sheep produces the best wool. That is mind acting with a goal in mind. Nature does not have a mind. It doesn't know what to expect. So what does natural selection have to do? It has to take what is given. So if you imagine an animal, and here is this herd of, say, giraffes or whatever, and a drought comes along, what if there happens to be no animals at that time, no individuals within this population that can survive a drought, that are adapted, to use the evolutionary term, adapted to this drought condition? They'll all die off. They'll become extinct, or that particular herd will, perhaps. It can only work on what it is given. So that's a real problem with this analogy to artificial selection. Well, Darwin had a problem too. Eventually, his critics and him came to an agreement that, in fact, natural selection could not produce this long-term, large-scale change. But then at the turn of this century, there was a new science came to the fore. In fact, it had already gone on around Darwin's time, but then got lost. But the science of genetics came on the scene. And people began to learn more about how we pass on our characteristics from one generation to the next, how it is that you look somewhat like your brothers and sisters, how you look like your parents, how the grandmothers are able to go up to the babies and say, well, he's got his father's eyes, and he's got his mother's chin, or whatever it happens to be, that they know basically how those rules of inheritance work, and that they know that there's things, there's actually something within ourselves that contains that information. And we talked a little bit about that this morning. The DNA, specifically the genes, not Levi genes, but genes, G-E-N-E-S, that contain that information. Well, early on in this century, people discovered that mistakes could occur in those genes, changes, which they called mutations. And if you have mutations, then you're able to make new material. You're able to make new traits, new characteristics that natural selection can work upon. So in the 1920s, Darwinian evolution was modified into something called neo-Darwinian evolution, or new Darwinism, which put together the science of genetics with Darwin's observations of natural selection and said natural selection working on mutations can cause long-term large-scale change. Well, let's look at the mutations. I think there are three problems there. First of all, mutations are very rare. I believe it's a testament to the design of the cells within our bodies that we actually make very few mistakes when it comes to our genes. Your cells, your body cells, continue through your life. There are very few cells. In fact, they used to think that nerve cells don't make new copies of themselves, but I think they're even changing that idea. Our body cells constantly make new copies of themselves. And that copying goes on, for the most part, in a very regular fashion. If mistakes are made, the body automatically corrects it. And even from generation to generation, within the sex cells, very few mistakes are made, and if they're made, they're corrected by nature. So, for a start, mutations are very rare, and so there's not this volume of new material that would be open to selection by nature. The second problem is that mutations tend to be random. In fact, they're nearly always random. Again, you've got the same problem. Natural selection can only work with what is given by nature. There's no mind at work saying, well, gee, we need a mutation to help us survive this drought, so let's cook up a mutation here. They can only get that if it's already present within the population, which means that there is actually no evolution going on in a long-term, large-scale sense, but natural selection is simply modifying the proportions of different characteristics that are already present within the population. Problem number three is that mutations are nearly always neutral, which means they basically don't have anything to offer, good or bad, in survival. If a person is bald, I can talk about that because I happen to have a full head of hair right now. So that's a good example for me to use. But what survival qualities, what survival advantages do you have with having no hair? Exactly what does that do? I don't know. Nothing. It doesn't, as far as I know, I can't even think of one. I'm sure I could think of a joke offhand if I wasn't in such a hurry. But anyway, I've seen a mug that somewhere that says bald men don't waste hormones, but I don't know. Other than that, I don't know what other advantages there are. It's whatever mutation it was that causes male pattern baldness, which is a predominant trait. It's if you get that from your mother, then you have a pretty good chance that you're going to be bald when you're 30 or whatever. But that's neutral. In fact, a lot of mutations are just downright harmful. They will cause real problems in the person. They will cause congenital diseases. They, in fact, may result in the natural abortion of whatever baby it is that's there. And nature has that way of sorting things out. So most mutations, in fact, are harmful to an organism and are not this wonderful panacea for natural selection. So there you have basically the problem with natural selection working on mutations. Well, Darwin had something else to say in his book as well, and one last thing on Darwin itself. He realized that people would ask this question, and I don't know, lots of people ask me this question, and you may have asked it yourself. Well, if evolution is true, why don't we see it going on around us today? Is that a question that you ask a lot or hear your kids ask? That's the first question that comes to mind, and Darwin dealt with that in his book. He said, well, you know, evolution is gradual. It is so imperceptible from one generation to the next that we, in our limited lifetimes, simply are not going to notice it. So what we need to do is look at the long eons. There's an assumption, of course, that there are long eons of geological time. There we are going to find the evidence for long-term, large-scale evolution. And he said what we should find. He used this phrase. He said we should find innumerable transitional forms. Now, innumerable just means unnumbered, you know, just tons and tons of transitional forms. You may know it by the name of missing links. The links or the transitions as one species gradually transforms into another, that those will be in a fossil record. Now, in Darwin's day, they weren't there. They just hadn't, he felt like, collected enough fossils. Great tracts of the world had not been explored by geologists, and so they had a very poor record to look at. He said, but they will, you know, trust me, they will find innumerable transitional forms. Well, that was over 140 years ago. Where are the transitional forms? I mean, we sure have collected a lot of fossils in those years. And there are some that are offered. And I think a famous example that you may be familiar with, again, a classic textbook example, is the Archaeopteryx. This creature that looks kind of half reptile, half bird. And so they say, well, there you go. You know, if you think it's half reptile and half bird, then there must be a transitional form. Halfway between a reptile, or as they believe now, a dinosaur, something like the Compsognathus, any child under 10 knows exactly what I'm talking about, and a full-fledged bird. And so there's a classic case of a transitional form. But let's look at this Archaeopteryx. It was capable of flight. It had the flight muscles. It had special bone that supported those muscles. It might not have been a condor or an albatross, but it could fly. But most especially, it had fully formed feathers. This fossil was so well preserved that we can look at the fossils, look at the imprints of the feathers in this fine mud that was recovered from a quarry, a mudstone recovered from a quarry in Germany, that we can see the individual filaments of these feathers. You know, and a feather is just not just a light thing that happens on the edge of a bird's wing. You know, this is a very complicated, it's got a hollow bone, it's got these hooks and things so that the bird can preen it, and then when it puts it back, they will lock back together again. There are all sorts of different types of feathers. This is not just a kind of a fluffy scale from a lizard. This is a very complicated structure. Where did this come from? There is nothing in the fossil record that even hints where this feather came from. So yes, the Archaeopteryx is a very strange bird. But to say, well, this proves that birds evolved from dinosaurs or birds evolved from reptiles, well, that's a whole other matter. So that's my first problem with the fossil record as presented to us by the evolutionists, is that these innumerable transitional forms don't exist, or they're questionable at least. The second problem is that these fossils seem to appear out of nowhere. You may have heard of something called the Cambrian explosion. This is a time when, at a certain level in the geological record, where fossils simply appear out of nowhere. You've got complicated animals, like the trilobite with its segmented body and its eyes that are adapted, or I would say designed, to see in the depths of the water. It is a wonderful creature. And many, many other types of creatures that we're familiar with all appear suddenly within the fossil record. There are some fossils that appear just before them in the geological column, and they're weird. I mean, for a long time, geologists didn't know which way was up. I mean, they are so strange. They occur in China and also in the Burgess Shale of British Columbia. And then before that, in the fossil record, maybe some algae, maybe some bacteria. That's all that's there. And then what about life itself? I mean, Darwin's theory concerned itself with life as we see it. What about life itself? How did life come to be from non-living, inorganic or organic matter? It doesn't matter whether it's organic or not. How did life come to be from nothing? And this is absolutely a real problem for Darwinian evolution. So and there's a third problem with the fossil record, and that is stasis. Now, stasis is just the opposite for evolution. Evolution means change. Stasis means things stay the same. So if we find a lot of stability, a lot of things that are not changing in the fossil record, then what does that say about evolution? We are told by people like Harvard's Stephen Jay Gould that evolution is a fact. Now, we may disagree, in fact, Stephen Jay Gould does, with the details of the theory about whether it's natural selection or some other process that's been in operation. But we all know that evolution is a fact. But when you look at the fossil record, you find, in fact, a lot of things don't change. We find creatures like the coelacanth recovered off the waters of South Africa in the 1920s or 30s. That looks substantially the same as fossils that were thought by the evolutionists to have become extinct a couple hundred million years ago. The cockroach appears in a fossil record, and it's basically the same. And it's probably the same one that's running around my house right now, in fact. We find in Jurassic Park, the movie, found, what it made famous was these insects in amber. And amber is recovered from around the Baltic Sea. It's recovered all the way through the Caribbean in New Jersey. And these insects, like a bee, they found a bee preserved in amber. And they were able, they didn't make a dinosaur or anything out of them, what was the stomach contents or of this bee, but they found bacteria. And the bacteria in this bee is the same type of bacteria that they find in the stomachs of bees flying around in that same area of the world today. So stability, not change, seems to be the rule in the fossil record. Well, how can evolution be a fact? Oh, and then you've got the whole problem. If things stay the same for so long, what causes that dramatic, sudden transformation from reptile into Archaeopteryx into a fully fledged bird? What is going on? What mechanism can explain that? There is none. So these are my problems with evolution or Darwinian evolution as it applies to biology, and that's the first area that I wanted to look at. I want to change gears completely now, really, and look at Darwinian evolution as it applies to society. When I first started writing the paper for this lecture, I was going to blow that off. I was going to say, well, no one really seriously would think that Darwinian evolution applies to human societies today. Now, maybe in the past, and we'll talk about that, but no one would seriously believe that language and art and poetry, paintings, ethics, that these things would be the product of Darwinian evolution. And to my chagrin, I found out that wasn't true. So let's talk about that. The first man on the scene in this area was an English philosopher and a close associate, not necessarily a friend, but a close associate of Charles Darwin, known as Herbert W. Spencer. He was a philosopher, like I said, very popular in his time. He had this idea, even before Darwin came along with his theory, that the way English society, in fact, he would extend this to most Western societies, maybe the American society, but certainly with regard to the English society, that the way the English society had developed with its hierarchy of the working class, the middle class, and the upper class, just had to be the way it was because nature wouldn't have made it any other way. It just had to be that the working class masses were there, and then you had your middle class, and then you had the rich people, the wealthy, the nobility, taking advantage of everyone beneath them. That's just the way it was. And so he advocated that government, and especially religion, should keep its noses out of doing anything in society. They shouldn't build poor houses. They shouldn't feed the poor. They shouldn't give them money. They shouldn't give them charity. That this would be counterproductive to nature. Now, nowadays, especially in the 1990s, with welfare reform and everything, that may sound kind of familiar to you. Maybe that's what we should do. We should help these people. But when I say poor, I want you to understand what I mean. The working poor, the poor who would work 10, 12, 17, 20 hours a day and would not be able to feed their family, clothe their family, and house their family. This was the situation. And Spencer said, leave them alone. Don't make laws that will make their life better. Don't give them the vote, you know, because then they want to upset things. If they really can survive, if they really have the wherewithal to survive, so be it. But don't get in the way of natural selection. So that's what he did. He borrowed Darwin's natural selection for his own purposes. Darwin would have nothing of it. I think there's a good sign there. If the father of a particular scientific theory, who knows that scientific theory backwards, doesn't approve of an idea, then that should give you an indication that maybe it was wrong to start off with. But in fact, it was Herbert W. Spencer who coined the term survival of the fittest. And later on, in later editions of The Origin of Species, which Darwin published in 1859, but in later editions, Darwin reluctantly put survival of the fittest as a phrase instead of natural selection for various reasons, but he didn't like that. What's wrong with this idea? Well, it fell out of favor. People were just turned off by it. They just didn't like this idea. They just thought it was abusive. They thought it opened up for others to take advantage of the poor and those who couldn't look after themselves. So it fell out of favor. Also, Spencer had this idea of progress, inevitable progress, society like life. He was wrong in this respect, but society like the living world itself has some big objective, has some big goal, and it's going to ever strive to reach that higher level. But then the American Civil War came along, and Spencerism, or social Darwinism as it was known, was very popular in this part of the world too. The American Civil War came along, and then the final nail in the coffin was the First World War in Europe, and people said, if this is progress, you can forget Spencer. We don't want anything to do with this sort of progress. So they realized that progress really wasn't an inevitable part of our culture. There are some other problems, two of them I'd like to focus on. One is a problem, a philosophical problem, which affects nearly all ethical theories, non-Christian ethical theories throughout the ages. And that is that you cannot reason from is to ought. You cannot reason from is to ought. In fact, some people have gone as far to say that this is a fallacy of reasoning. They call it the naturalistic fallacy. You cannot go from nature to ethics. Cannot go from is to ought. And just to give you an example, let's say there's an interstate, stretch of interstate, that has signs posted 70 miles per hour is the speed limit. No higher than 70 miles per hour. Now, the average speed in that stretch of highway is 75 miles an hour. What is the right speed? Test here for you. Now, according to the law, it's 70 miles per hour. But everyone's going 75 miles per hour. Doesn't that make it right? Well, not according to the law. In fact, I would say the Bible would say not either. Apart from obeying the laws of the land, it says thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. So that is not a good track for us to follow. And it's the same way in nature. Some people have said, well, it is by the nature of man to seek pleasure. Therefore, we should seek pleasure. It is of the nature of man that we reason, therefore we ought to reason. It is of the nature of man to seek power, therefore we ought to seek power. But that doesn't necessarily hold. You cannot validly reason from is to ought. So that's the major philosophical problem with it. And of course it does have a biblical problem. Does the Bible want us to compete and to struggle? Sure. Are we not in a war against principalities and powers and the forces of darkness in this world? Sure we are. Do we not want to run the race and fight the good fight? Yes, we do. But it is not a struggle with each other. It is a spiritual struggle for a spiritual goal. Our goal, our highest goal, is heaven. The greatest good is to love God and keep His commandments. And the second greatest good is to love our neighbor as ourself. Whatever we do, we are doing it for those reasons and those reasons alone. It's not struggle for us. It's not struggle for our own egoistical sake, but struggle for the kingdom of God. So a fundamental difference between Christianity and social Darwinism. The Old Testament provided for the poor. It had a Sabbath year. It said, you leave your field open. You know, don't do anything with your field once every 7 years. And same with your vineyards. And same with your olive groves. The poor can use that if they want to. Don't pick up every grain of wheat. Don't pick up every grape that falls on the ground. Don't pick up every olive that falls on the ground during the harvest. Leave that for the poor. Leave the corners of your field for the poor. Loan money to the poor, but don't charge interest. Or even give them money outright. You treat the poor with equal justice as the rich man. The Bible was very conscious that the poor are with us and they need to be provided for. God is a just God and He has made provisions for the poor. In the New Testament, we find that there is relief for widows and orphans. We find Paul collecting money for the saints in Judea. What's the problem with the saints in Judea? That they wouldn't work? Oh, they could work. Could they buy food? Only if they had a lot of money. You know, if you're in a drought, if you're in a famine, then what's going to be the most expensive thing? It's going to be the food. So that's why they sent the money, so they could afford to buy the food. You'll notice that in a famine, it's not the rich people who starve. It's like our oil crisis of 1973. People called it sometimes the oil shortage. Well, there was plenty of oil there. We just couldn't get it. And when we could get it, we had to line up and pay a lot of money for it, and the price of oil really increased in price. That was the problem, not that it was a shortage. Jesus said in Mark 9, verse 35, if anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. And of course, the greatest servant we have as an example for us, putting himself over everyone in the entire world, is Jesus Christ. So social Darwinism is an idea that clearly conflicts with biblical doctrines. Well, you might say, well, why argue against social Darwinism? I mean, isn't that an idea that's seen its day? Well, no, because it strikes a chord with people. I was in a class not so long ago, and a scenario was put out of some people who had survived a sinking of a ship. That's the old classic example. You've got like 120 people. You've got a lifeboat that can only take 50 and there are 70 in it. Who are going to survive? Should you jump overboard and let somebody take your place? Should the women and children get in the lifeboat and the men hop out? I mean, who is going to decide who lives? And one of the guys in the class said, well, survival of the fittest. There he was, Herbert W. Spencer, rearing his ugly head. So sure enough, there are those who wish to justify what they do by social Darwinism or Spencerism. They don't need Darwin. I mean, men have always justified greed. They've always found some way to justify their immoral, unethical practices. But nonetheless, it's convenient for them to do so. I want to just briefly bring up two more men who are of more modern vintage. One is a guy called Edward O. Wilson. He's a Harvard entomologist. And he invented a term in a study called sociobiology. And it manifests itself basically as something called evolutionary psychology or evolutionary sociology. And it says that basically what we're about is passing on our genes to the next generation. Now, you may think that you love your husband, or you may think that you love your wife, but love is a shorthand way of saying, I value you for your ability to pass my genes on to the next generation. And it's just a whole lot easier to say, I love you. But that's basically all that means. And I read a newspaper article a little while ago. And they did a survey of Australian college women and found that these women, surprising, I can't understand why, but they preferred slim men. And this was an astounding thing that was worthy of reporting in a newspaper. I guess they had some space left. And I guess that they didn't feel satisfied unless they went to see a local evolutionist to see what he had to say about it. So they trotted down to the local museum and asked the evolutionist. He said, "That's just a fad. It'll pass." Now, what they're really interested in, if they really had their head screwed on right, is they will choose a man for his status, his wealth, and his power. That will be the basis of what a woman should choose in her mate, because she wants to make sure that her genes will survive to the next generation. Again, we've got a problem of reasoning from is to ought. Now, they're not saying, well, what we ought to do is pick our mate on the basis of some evolutionary considerations. But nonetheless, we ought to think about each other. We ought to think about humans. Think about perhaps, and this is where Wilson comes in and says, we ought to think about an ethic which takes these things into account based upon our evolutionary heritage. And a lot of this, of course, has to do with genes. Our genes make us do it. There's a gene for alcoholism. This is what some people claim. There's a gene for alcoholism, a gene for homicide, a gene for homosexuality, a gene for all these things. Now, I want to tell you a simple scientific fact. Genes make proteins. That's what they do. They make proteins. Now, proteins can take the form of amino, can take the form of hormones. They can take the form of enzymes. Proteins themselves can be just building blocks, like for your bones or whatever. But genes make proteins. What proteins is it that causes one man to get into bed with another? What protein is it that causes a person to take the lid off the bottle cap or go down to the local store and buy a six-pack of beer? What protein causes that? Now, I understand that there may be a genetic predisposition to being addicted to a drug, to being addicted to alcohol. But where is that protein that actually causes us to do these things? They're not there. It's a very, very tenuous connection. And then there's Richard Dawkins, and he will get under your skin quicker than anybody else. He's one of these annoying Englishmen who really thinks that you're wrong. I mean, you don't have to be non-English to think he's wrong, that you're wrong, but anybody's wrong, because he is what they call an ultra-Darwinist. And he believes that, well, maybe we can't apply Darwinian evolution directly to our genes as far as culture and behavior and ethics are concerned. But he draws an analogy, and he's invented something called memes. Well, it's nice because it rhymes with genes. And so the idea is that evolution or Darwinian ideas can work on these memes. And there's a meme for Levi jeans, and there's a meme for Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and there's a meme for various songs and poems and art. These are all memes. All the elements of culture are a meme, and some memes are more successful than others. And why is that? What is the survival value of this meme? And he says, well, religion is a very successful meme. But then he had a quote. He had a quote with a journalist once, and he said, well, you know, there are some viruses. The smallpox virus is a very successful meme. That doesn't mean I don't want to stamp it out. Now, you can see very clearly where he stands. He believes that religion, Christianity, is a meme, it's successful, and it can be stamped out. He has a follower, a philosopher here in the States called Daniel Dennett. He recently published a book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And Dennett clearly said, if you want to teach your children the lie of creation, I reserve the right to take that creation story away from them, to take that religion away from them. He said, save the Baptists? Yes, but not at any cost. Put religion in museums. Make the churches into museums. This is their agenda. They really don't so much, in the case of these modern sociobiologists and people like Dawkins with his memetics, they don't so much want to erect an evolutionary ethics as they want to get rid of Christianity. They want to get rid of religious ethics. That is what they're about. All based on, it's a fact. Evolution is a fact. Therefore, this is how we ought to live our lives, and this is how we ought to think. One last thing, and I know my time is up. two ideas so far I've talked about is us responding to evolution out there, to the evolutionists, to the sort of stuff that your children get at college and at high school. But what about between you and me? I want to talk about that just briefly. What people want to do is say, evolution is true, God exists, and I can just put the two together. And I want to tell you, brothers and sisters, that that cannot be done. And one of the clues that I have for that that can't be done is Darwin himself. He couldn't see the sense of it. And I'm going to rely completely on him for this rebuttal of this idea. His first criticism was it didn't make sense. He said, natural selection is it. Natural selection can account for every single living thing on this planet. I don't need God. He called himself an agnostic, but he said, I don't need God to help out with natural selection. It is completely able, it is completely successful at explaining how all the living things in this world could come about. I don't want God poking his nose in that. I don't need it.